From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
O ye daughters of Africa, awake, awake, arise! No longer sleep nor slumber, but distinguish yourselves. Show forth to the world that ye are endowed with noble and exalted faculties.
Daughters of Africa, we bring you the Yari Yari Conference of Black Writers of the Diaspora, like former Black Panthers Elaine Brown and Angela Davis. And today is a national day of protest to stop police brutality. You'll hear from Ossie Davis, Michael Moore, and others. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Alan J. Bannister, a prisoner who's been on Missouri's death row longer than any other, was executed by injection early this morning. He was convicted of carrying out a contract killing on a man who was living with another man's wife. He says he did not commit a contract killing. Bannister said in a final statement, the state of Missouri is committing a premeditated murder as possible. His final appeals were rejected yesterday by Missouri Governor Mel Carnahan and the U.S. Supreme Court. Originally from Illinois, Bannister was convicted in 1983 of killing Daryl Russman of Joplin a year earlier. Russman died from a single shot to his heart after answering a knock at the front door of his mobile home. Prosecutors said Bannister had been hired for $4,000 and given a pistol to kill Russman, who was living with another man's wife. Bannister admitted killing Russman, but said the gun went off accidentally during a scuffle. He said he should have been convicted of nothing worse than second-degree murder, which isn't punishable by death, but a bungled defense led to a guilty verdict. He was kept in jail for a year before the trial. He met with his attorney only for 1 hour. The trial lasted 3 days, and the arresting police officer sent a letter to the Missouri governor saying that the case has been bungled. UN human investigators were able to talk privately with 30 Chinese prisoners in a rare look inside China's prisoners, jails, and labor camps. This, according to a UN spokesperson. China allowed investigators Kapil Sibal of India and Louis Joannet of France to select 30 prisoners for private interviews at detention centers in Beijing and provinces across China. In Lhasa, Tibet, however, the Chinese allowed the UN workers to speak to only 4 or 5 prisoners from a long list of detainees they'd asked to see there. A veteran human rights campaigner appealed to President Clinton today to use next week's summit with China's leader to urge the release of jail dissidents. In an open letter sent to human rights groups, Qin Shangmin thanked Clinton for seeking his freedom in a 1993 meeting with Chinese President Jiang Zemin, the first between the two leaders. With Clinton and Jiang set to hold their most significant talks to date on October 29th, Qin reminded the U.S. president that the United States still has an important role in promoting the improvement of human rights in China. Qin asked Clinton to request the release of Li Hai, Liu Nianchun, and Zhou Guoqiang, all, like Qin himself, members of the Peace Charter Movement, a group pressing for nonviolent democratic change. South African President Nelson Mandela left for Tunisia today en route to Libya for a 2-day visit. That's peak, the United States. President Hosni Mubarak bid farewell to Mandela, who arrived in Cairo on Monday on the first leg of his four-nation North African tour. Mandela will travel by road from the Tunisian capital Tunis to Libya to avoid violating UN air sanctions. The United States, which accuses Libya of sponsoring terrorism, says it would be disappointed if Mandela goes ahead with the visit. Mandela has rejected the U.S. position as racist. From Cuba to Argentina, Latin American governments are making new attempts to silence critical journalism, one of the Western Hemisphere's leading press groups is charging. Luis Gabriel Cano, outgoing president of the Inter-American Press Association, says an end to dictatorships and wars in the region have not meant an end to efforts to muzzle the news media. In fact, Cano says moves to restrict the press and silence voices critical of governments throughout the region are increasing. Venezuelan attempts to draft a code of truthful information, Brazilian proposals to fine journalists for publishing crimes, and Cuba's new decree for foreign journalists all set dangerous precedents, this according to Cano. President Clinton's nomination of Bill Lan Li to head the government's top civil rights office has lacked the outcry from conservatives that doomed his first choice for the job in 1993. But a few fireworks are expected from the Senate Judiciary Committee when it launches its review today. Republicans, many of whom want to eliminate affirmative action, control the panel and will sharply question Li about his views. Li supports affirmative action. He's the Western Regional Counsel for the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund based in Los Angeles. Ginkgo biloba extract, an herbal medicine used for thousands of years by the Chinese, has been shown to slow the progression of Alzheimer's disease slightly in some patients. In a study to be published today in the Journal of the American Medical Association, researchers say about a third of the dementia patients treated with ginkgo extract showed some improvement after 52 weeks when compared with a similar group who took a placebo. And that's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Under the watchwords of Yari Yari, or the future of the future in Sierra Leone, hundreds of women gathered this weekend in New York City at New York University to focus attention on the experience of women writers of the African diaspora. The three-day Yari Yari Conference was the first major international gathering devoted to the evaluation and celebration of literature by women of African descent. We're joined now by Margaret Busby, who came in this weekend for the conference. She is a leading figure in Black and literary cultural forums in Britain and the editor of Daughters of Africa, an international anthology of words and writings by women of African descent.
O ye daughters of Africa, awake, awake, arise. No longer sleep nor slumber, but distinguish yourselves. Show forth to the world that ye are endowed with noble and exalted faculties. That's from Maria Stewart's Productions of Mrs. Maria W. Stewart, 1835. To Black Women. Sisters, where there is cold silence, no hallelujahs, no hurrahs at all, no handshakes, no neon red or blue, no smiling faces, prevail. Prevail across the editors of the world who are obsessed, self-honeying and self-crowned in the seduced arena. It has been a hard trudge, with fainting, bandaging, and death. There have been startling confrontations. There have been tramplings, tramplings of monarchs and of other men. But there remain large countries in your eyes, shrewd sun, the civil balance, the listening secrets, and you create and train your flowers still. That's Gwendolyn Brooks's To Black Women.
That's Margaret Busby. She is the editor of a really amazing anthology called Daughters of Africa, an international anthology of words and writings by women of African descent from the ancient Egyptian to the present. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. She has come over from Britain for this past weekend's Yari Yari Conference. Tell us about the conference.
Yari Yari is a wonderful conference. It's the first event of its kind. It's the first major international collection of Black women writers in a conference to have taken place ever. And it's a bit as if my book had come to life, because there are so many people I'm meeting for the first time who are in the book, and those who I've already met. So it's as if the book has just sprung to life, and it's fantastic. It's a wonderful feeling to be here.
How did your book come about? How did you come to decide to put the Daughters of Africa together in a volume?
I guess the reason I was delighted when the opportunity came up to do it was that it was a book I had wished I could have had during my student days or during my school days, particularly because I went to school in Britain, I went through secondary school, university, and I was never required to read a single book by a Black writer, let alone a Black woman writer. And so I, over the years, had to educate myself and look out material. And so I wanted to put together a book that represented all the things that were missing, because I would buy an anthology of African writers, for example, African poets, say, and it would not say an anthology of poetry by African men, and yet there'd be no women in it. Or I'd buy a book of, you know, short stories by Black American writers. It wouldn't say by men, but, you know, you'd find there's an absence of women and so on. So I wanted to do a book that showed that Black women had been creating over generations, over many years, and it was not just a recent phenomenon with the well-known writers we know, such as Maya Angelou and Toni Morrison and Alice Walker. It had been going on for many generations, and also that the creativity took so many different forms. It was not just what was written on the page, and it was not just particular genres, fiction, non-fiction. There were letters. There were all sorts of things. And there was also the oral tradition. So I was just trying to put in one volume as much as I could to represent the diversity of creativity of women of African descent around the world.
Can you tell me a little about your background?
My background. I was born in Ghana, West Africa. So was my mother. So was my mother's mother. In fact, we're fancies, so you say you go through the matrilineal, right? You go through the mother's line, and you're not so sure where the men may come from. But in fact, in my family, my father was from the Caribbean. He emigrated to Ghana in 1929. And my mother's father was also from the Caribbean, from Dominica. He emigrated to Ghana in 1902. So in a way, I feel as if I embody this sort of diasporan feeling that's coming through. I wanted to put through not only in this book, but also I felt in the Yari Yari conference that's just taking place in New York University. So I think I feel as if I come from a lot of different places. I'm African, but I'm African from a lot of different places, although I was born in Ghana. And the rest of my background I can sum up by saying I started the publishing company straight out of university, which I then ran. It was a company called Allison & Busby. And after I stopped doing that, I put together Daughters of Africa, and here I am still doing other things. And yeah, I don't want to go into too much detail. You'd be on the air for too long.
You started by reading a poem by Gwendolyn Brooks. Tell us about Gwendolyn Brooks.
Yes, Gwendolyn Brooks. I read that poem by Gwendolyn Brooks, which was called To Black Women, because Gwendolyn Brooks is one of the women writers, the black women writers, who I think is has been important not only to America but to the rest of the world. And she was in fact the first black writer of either gender to win a Pulitzer Prize, which was in 1950 for her book of poems Annie Allen. And she was also named Poet Laureate of Illinois in 1968, succeeding Carl Sandburg. And she's founded the publishing company. So she's one of the women who embodies the excellence that black women writers are capable of, and I think that's why she's important. She's a foremother, she's a beacon, she's something that we should aspire to be like, if you like, and she's not finished yet. She's done a lot, going back to that first Pulitzer Prize in 1950, and, that's something to remember.
And Maria Stewart, Arise, Ye Daughters of Africa.
Yes, Maria Stewart, from whom I took the title for the anthology, was the first African-American, the first American-born woman to lecture in public. And the notoriety that came from that made her move to New York. She was actually born in Connecticut. And she attended school there and became a teacher there. And her first pamphlet, which was published in 1835, was called The Productions of Mrs. Maria W. Stewart. And that's from that pamphlet that I took the title. She addresses black women, exhorting them to strive for education and political rights. And the phrase from which the title comes, as I said at the beginning, went, "O ye daughters of Africa, awake, awake, arise." And I think that really is an apt epigram, if you like, epigraph, whatever the word is. It's an apt phrase to hold in mind in terms of not only what we're capable of, but just to show that things have changed, that we are gathering together, as at the Yari Yari conference, as this book tries to do, show that we have common links, that we can go forward, not just look back.
Do you include slave writers in Daughters of Africa?
There are slave narratives, yes, and I think one has to remember the circumstances in which some of the things were written, because it's not always easy, and it certainly hasn't been in terms of our history, and it still is not when you think of the literacy rates in present-day Africa, as well as the conditions of the women who were trying to write for different reasons. I mean, maybe to keep themselves or their children going and, sell their writings in more difficult times. So I think sometimes the standard varies, of course, because some writers have more education than others. Some don't write for the page, some write to perform, some write for the voice. So I think this book just tried to show the variety and not to be judgmental, to say because this piece of writing or this piece of creativity, this piece of oratio came out of a particular situation, one must look at it in this way or that. I'm saying here it is.
Who are some of your favorite authors that you put into Daughters of Africa?
That's a question I'm often asked, and my favorites change all the time. I mean, there are writers I've always loved, such as Toni Morrison, of course. But there are other writers whose stories are less successful, such as the South African writer Bessie Head, who died relatively young. Her life was very tragic, but she was a brilliant writer. I'll give you some background about Bessie, because Bessie had never got her due in her lifetime, I feel. And I think that isn't necessarily an unusual thing for a lot of our writers. I mean, Bessie Head was born in South Africa. She was a biracial child, if you like. Her mother was white and from a wealthy family, and her father was black. And because of this alliance, her mother was certified insane. So Bessie grew up in foster homes and became a teacher and became a journalist and had an unhappy marriage and moved to Botswana, where she settled. And she had a precarious sort of refugee status for many years and finally gained citizenship. And her works draw a lot on her own life. But she died at the age of 49, and she never had enough money to do the things she should do, and it's just a tragic story, but she is a brilliant writer.
What did you include of her works here?
Well, there's a story, little vignette that I like. I included more than one, but I'll read you a little. This is a little vignette called The Old Woman. She was so frail that her whole body swayed this way and that, like a thin stalk of corn in the wind. Her arms were flat as boards. The flesh hung loosely, and her hands, which clutched the walking stick, were turned outwards and knobbled with age. Under her long dress also swayed the tattered edges of several petticoats. The ends of two bony stick legs peeped out. She had on a pair of sand shoes. The toes were all sticking out, so that the feet flapped about in them. She wore each shoe on the wrong foot, so that it made the heart turn over with amusement. Yet she seemed so strong that it was a shock when she suddenly bent double, retched and coughed emptily, and crumbled to the ground like a quiet sigh. "What is it, Mum? What's the matter?" I asked. "Water, water," she said faintly. "Wait a minute, I shall ask at this hut here if there is any water." "What's the matter?" they asked. "The old lady is ill," I said. "No," she said curtly, "I'm not ill, I am hungry." The crowd laughed in embarrassment that she should display her need so nakedly. They turned away. But old ladies have no more shame left. They are like children. They give way to weakness and cry openly when they are hungry. "Never mind," I said. "Hunger is a terrible thing. My hut is not far away. This small child will take you. Wait till I come back, then I shall prepare food for you." Then it was late afternoon. The old lady had long passed from my mind, when a strange young woman, unknown to me, walked into the yard with a pail of water on her head. She set it down outside the door and squatted low. "Good day, how are you?" I said. She returned the greeting, keeping her face empty and carefully averted. It's impossible to say, "What do you want? Whom are you looking for?" It's impossible to say this to a carefully averted face and a body that squats quietly, patiently. I looked at the sky helplessly. I looked at the trees, I looked at the ground, but the young woman said nothing. I did not know her, inside or out. Many people I do not know who know me, inside and out, and always it is this way, this silence. A curious neighbour looked over the hedge. "What's the matter?" she asked. I turned my eyes to the sky again, shrugging helplessly. "Please ask the young woman what she wants, whom she's looking for." The young woman turned her face to the neighbour, still keeping it averted, and said quietly, "No, tell her she helped our relative who collapsed this morning. Tell her the relatives discussed the matter. Tell her we had nothing to give in return, only that one relative said she passes by every day on her way to the water tap. Then we decided to give a pail of water. It is all we have. Tell them, too. Tell them how natural, sensible, normal as human kindness. Tell them, those who judge my country Africa by gain and greed, that the gods walk about her barefoot with no ermine and gold-studded cloaks.
Margaret Busby reading Bessie Head, South African author, an old woman. Bessie Head died in 1986 at the age of 49. Margaret Busby, thanks so much for joining us. Margaret Busby is the editor of Daughters of Africa, an international anthology of words and writings by women of African descent. When we come back, you'll hear from Angela Davis and Elaine Brown, author of A Taste of Power. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. At the Yari Yari Conference this past weekend at New York University, where black women gathered from the diaspora, black women writers, there was one conference on women writers, women biographers, women autobiographers. Among the people who spoke were Elaine Brown, who is author of A Taste of Power, a memoir of her experiences as a member and leader of the Black Panthers, and also Angela Davis, teacher, writer, scholar, and organizer, first came to national attention in 1969 when she was dismissed from a teaching position at UCLA for membership in the Communist Party. In 1970, she was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, but after 16 months in prison, she was acquitted of the charges against her. She subsequently wrote an autobiography and a number of other books, including Women, Race, and Class. She currently teaches at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Angela Davis.
So I want to raise some questions about the responsibility of those of us who do have a voice, who have access of a certain access to the public, about the responsibility with respect to addressing those hard questions that many black communities don't want to talk about. And those questions, you know, I've alluded to the two issues that I want to raise in connection with women who are consistently marginalized and silenced. You know, women who are on welfare and who already in New York, I mean, those of you who are from New York know what's been happening here. But on January 1st, of course, the federal welfare law goes into effect. And the dominant discourse about welfare mothers as intentionally lazy and intentionally unemployed is a discourse that has become very much a part of conversations in black communities. And that is why in the welfare debate that spanned a couple of years, I mean, it's amazing that they devoted so much time to a question that actually related to a minute percentage of the federal budget. I mean, it was almost as if all we have to do is abolish the welfare system and all of our problems will be solved. Our problems with education will be solved, there will be no more homeless, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I also want to raise the issue of the increasing rate of imprisonment of black women. This is something that we have not yet learned how to talk about, even though some of us know how to talk about the fact that 32.2% of all young black men between the ages of 20 and 29 are in prison or on parole on probation, right? But we ignore the fact that in the very same report that revealed this incredible percentage of young black men to us, they indicated that black women experienced the largest increase in imprisonment rates of any other group. 78% more black women were in prison in 1995 than in 1990. And so what's going to happen come January 1st? And when we recognize the extent to which the welfare discourse pathologizes black women's lives in the same way that young black men are criminalized and pathologized by the discourse on criminality that defines and constructs him, then I think it should be clear that that something is wrong here. And even so, if you look at the differences, welfare women are forced to bear the burden of responsibility for their predicament. After all, it's argued that they decided to have children, quote, out of wedlock, whatever that means. You ever thought about the term wedlock, locked into? You know, I mean, there's the imprisonment metaphor there. But oftentimes in relation to the discussion about young black men, it's assumed that it's a question of social perception. Because so many middle-class black men are mistaken as those who are the criminals, right? So we've learned how to talk about the criminalization of young black men as a question of perception. But we talk about young black women as intentionally responsible for their predicament. Now, I think this has a lot to do with the increasing class divisions in black communities. And we have to figure out how to create some cross-class dialogues. You know? And I think we have to actually begin to develop a new vocabulary. And one of the terms I think that should become a part of our vocabulary is the prison industrial complex. The prison industrial complex. And by the way, some of us are organizing a national and international conference at UC Berkeley next September, September 98, on the prison industrial complex. So if you want some information about that, you should see me later. But finally, you know, what about the lives of women relegated to invisibility and silence? Women who live beyond the walls. Women who live beyond the razor wire. And since Elaine and I were once in that predicament, anybody else willing to join us now? you know, I want to end by connecting the self-representation of my life, or my effort at self-representation, with a responsibility to those who still live beyond the razor wire, and to ask you whether you can link your lives with the lives of your marginalized and silenced sisters.
You're listening to Angela Davis speaking at the Yari Yari Conference this past weekend at New York University, teacher, writer, scholar, and organizer. We now play a bit from Jane Cortez. She organized this conference, great rap singer.
Chairperson of the board is not digging for roots in the shadows. No dying of hunger stare in eyes of Chief Executive Officer of Petroleum. Somebody else is sinking into spring freeze of the soil. Somebody else is evaporating in dry winds of the famine. There's no severe drought in mouth of Senior Vice President of Funding Services. No military contractor is sitting in heat over disappearing lake. drying up in kidneys of a minister of defense. Undersecretary of Interior is not writing distress signals on toilet walls.
Jane Cortez and the Fire Spitters taking the blues back home. Yes, she's organizer of the Yari Yari Conference. As we move on to a second participant in one of the Yari Yari panels, Elaine Brown, author and head of the Fields of Flowers, an educational center for poor black children. She's former leader of the Black Panther Party, author of Taste of Power, a memoir of her experiences as a member and leader of the Black Panthers.
I want to just start out my brief comments by saying that I want to talk a little bit about how I came to write my book, so to speak. But I think the thing I want to talk about is that I always thought of my book as a slave narrative because of the obvious reasons that I am and have been a slave all of my life, in the sense that this is an oppressed society and that I certainly have been oppressed as a woman, a black person, and a poor person, which kind of like sort of unnecessary to say. But in any case, I was thinking about a book written by a friend of mine, Barbara Chase Reboux, who wrote the definitive work on Sally Hemings. And when Barbara's book first came out, the Jeffersonian scholars, you know, said, well, there was no Sally Hemings. This was sort of a black myth, you know. It was like black people have this myth, you know, there was a Sally Hemings. There was no Sally Hemings. So then Barbara said, well, you know, Jefferson kept careful records. Here's her name, you know, listed in the slave ledgers. Oh, well, 10 years later, well, there was a Sally Hemings. After the debate, there was a Sally Hemings, but she never had any children. Well, here are the Jefferson ledgers on the children. Okay, there was a Sally Hemings. She had children, but they didn't have red hair. Even though Aaron Burr had testified to it and many others had said there was these children running around with red hair and they're slaves, but they didn't have red hair. Okay, there was a Sally Hemings. She had children. They had red hair. But today's thing, in 1997, the Jefferson scholars are now saying there was a Sally Hemings who had children, but those children were the children of Thomas Jefferson's nephew. Because the nephew, but it was interesting because we have to wonder about sperm count, because the nephew was 12 when the first. So, but this is the denial of our story. This is how deeply denied we will be. Sally Hemings in 1997 is still being denied. Her existence is still being denied. And why? Because wouldn't it have been wonderful if Sally Hemings had been able to write her autobiography? And we would have known what was really happening. You know, how the rapes really occurred, you know? How she was an octoroon, huh? How she was one of the people that Thomas Jefferson was also experimenting with when he talked about how the only way that the black could escape the taint of blackness was to mix. And then the first pass of white blood would show an improvement and you would become a mulatto. Second pass, you would become a quadroon. Third pass, octoroon. And only when you reach 1/32nd black blood would you clear the taint. Sally might have been able to tell us something about that. So I think that the biography and the autobiography become obviously not only our narratives, but we witness ourselves and we testify for ourselves, and that we need that witnessing and we need that testimony, because otherwise, even 200 years after the fact, it's as though we were, not only were our lives erased when we were in them, but the very fact that we even showed up on the planet gets erased. So that's the first thing I just want to, and you know, give me the hook, because I've maybe not pay attention to the time. When I thought about writing this book, the only reason I really thought about writing is because I was in therapy at the time, and my therapist thought it was a better thing since I had left law school. And I didn't seem to be able to accomplish anything, unlike these sisters here who are like, you know, who are academics and brilliant women. I went to 3 colleges and 1 law school, and I don't have a 1 degree. So, kind of phenomenal. So somebody would ask, so I have been asked, you know, so who are you anyway, and why did you have to tell your story? But that's, you know, the way it is. Well, one reason I felt compelled to put pen to paper was really just an exercise that my therapist thought was a good idea. You know, I know Angela teaches, and, you know, it's cathartic when oppressed people get to at least articulate something about yourself, you know? So I had to do that. And so then it turned into this book, I felt that the importance of this narrative, my slave narrative, was that I testified about oppression. of little girls that grew up at 21st in York. If you want to narrow it, I mean, but there's a whole lot of 21st in Yorks from Philadelphia that come into Harlem and Detroit and Chicago and so forth. So I was one voice from the streets of North Philadelphia. I was one voice of somebody that really realized that I was oppressed over a period of time and yearned to be free. So I was a witness for a yearning to be free. And I was also and am a witness for the fact that you can survive no matter that you have been beaten down in so many different ways. And the last thing was that I was a witness that there was something about freedom that we all needed to address ourselves to. So it wasn't about a spiritual experience where I was going to adjust to the fact that, you know, it's my fault if I didn't understand a more positive thing about myself. No, there are criminal things that are going on in this country, but it wasn't me who was the criminal. And that I got to understand. So I testified. So then some people said, well, you know, I took a lot of criticism. First of all, the biggest criticism was, oh, I talked about a dog black man in the book. Now, the irony of that was that I talked about a lot of brothers that people had never heard of. I mean, and I elevated them and honored them in the way that I felt that they should be honored because it was my experience and it was as they passed through my life. So there, people forgot about Bunchy Carter and John Huggins and George Jackson and Jonathan Jackson and Fred Hampton and even Huey Newton, and especially Huey Newton, whom I honored in my way because this is how I saw these lives and these people touched my life. Now, just because I talked about the American Mobutu, for example, Ron Karenga, then people got upset with me. But So then they said. So then people said to me, "Well, you're not the only person with a story." Oh, well, really? I didn't know that. I thought I was the only one. Well, so I said to everybody, "Why don't you write your story?" And that's the other importance of it. Everybody does have a story. Where is not only Sally Hemings, but Sally Hemings' mama? We don't know anything about her. Barbara Chase Reboo's done this, but I mean, we generally, you know, I mean, we never heard of her. We can't even say. It's like a sister I remember, I can't remember her name, and said, you know, we talk about Lot's wife in the Bible. Nobody knows what her name was. She was like, Lot's wife. Lot's wife. So the criticism is heavy, and I'm trying to wind this up. The criticism is heavy. Then I was said, not only did I denigrate black men, not only did I arrogantly told my story, but then there was a question of they published your book because obviously either A, you're a sellout, you white people like you, you know, blah, 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 all those excuses for why they published my book. Now, all along, it was like the brother said to me one time, the problem with the black community is that black women are taking the jobs that black men should have. So we often wonder what those jobs were since so many of us are cleaning floors and, you know, so very, very briefly, because I know my time is just about up. Very briefly, I want to just say this, that the power, though, of writing biographies and of exposing women's lives and talking about ourselves is that we do shed light on our oppression. And by shedding that light, it becomes a freeing experience for all of us who participate in it. That we have a duty. That our duty is not to take responsibility for our oppression as Bill Clinton and this current new age racist cartel that's running this country would have us believe, that our children are not victims of their crimes, but are themselves criminals. So one of the things of testifying in your narrative and in this woman's narrative is to say, A, that we were here, B, that we meant something, C, that there is oppression, and D, that oppression must be ended. Lastly, I want to say this. I think that when we talk about writing the biographies and autobiographies, that we also have to include the people who don't have voice. I was lucky enough to have some voice, to have a platform from which to work, but there are many, many sisters out there, and I want to mention just one quick point. There was a sister in Atlanta where I live named Chantello Young. Anybody from Atlanta may remember, and some of you may have heard, last year her baby died in the project of Perry Homes choking on a roach. And this is 1996. Now, tell me about that. Now, where is the story of Chantello Young? Because she was dogged in the press. The press said, oh, well, unwed teen mother's baby dies choking on a roach in the projects. Well, how many stakes can you throw into her heart? Black people were like, oh, embarrassed. Head of the Atlanta Housing Authority, a woman, denounced her, said the reason she had roaches because she was dirty. Black women ran around and said, we're tired. We went along with that whole thing, the Clinton thing and the New Age racism and New Age sexism. We're tired of these black girls having all these babies. Nobody asked whose baby that was. Nobody asked the fact that 70% of these girls who are teen girls who are pregnant, their fathers are older men and have become pregnant through a variety of forms of rape. So the issue was, where's the story of Chantelle Young? And that's the next story that I think some of us who have voice and who have the ability to write, and all of you who are here obviously smart enough to even be having this conversation together, that that's our duty. When we talk about biographies and autobiographies, we also need to give voice to these people, and that's the power of the biography, and hopefully it will become a tool for our liberation.
You've been listening to Elaine Brown, author and the head of Fields of Flowers, an educational center for black and poor children. She's author of Taste of Power, a memoir of her experience as a member and leader of the Black Panther Party in California. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. Today we speak about stolen lives. Wednesday, October 22nd is a national day of protest to stop police brutality, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. All across the country, people are attending rallies, vigils, teach-ins, and marches to protest an epidemic of police brutality in the United States. If you want to link up with the protests taking place today, you can call 1-888-NO-BRUTALITY. That's 1-888-NO-BRUTALITY. The victims of police brutality are overwhelmingly African-American, Latino, and other people of color. Many victims are young. The Stolen Lives Project is gathering the names of people killed by the police and the U.S. Border Patrol. It's a project of the Anthony Baez Foundation, named for a young man who was killed by police in New York City. The October 22nd Coalition to Stop Police Brutality, and the National Lawyers Guild. The Center for Constitutional Rights is a sponsor. Begun less than a year ago, Stolen Lives have collected more than 500 names. Today, we hear a special reading of those names from the Stolen Lives Project. We're telling the world how they died. Their lives have been taken. They can't speak for themselves. But we can, and we will. Reading names from the Stolen Lives Project are poet Jarrett Quickly from Los Angeles, actor Melvin Van Peebles, filmmaker Michael Moore, and actor Ossie Davis.
Danette Strawberry Daniels, a 31-year-old African-American woman who was killed on June 7, 1997 by Newark, New Jersey police who claimed they arrested her for dealing drugs and had to shoot her after a scuffle broke out in the squad car. Witnesses say Strawberry, who was pregnant, wasn't buying drugs, and protests erupted on the spot when she was shot dead. Aaron Williams, African-American, was killed on June 4, 1995 in San Francisco when police asked him to come outside his home for questioning about a burglary. When he did, police swarmed him, ramming his head into a wall. 12 cops brought him to the ground, hogtied, beat him, and pepper sprayed him. One cop kicked him so hard it left a boot print. A surgical mask was placed over his nose and mouth to keep the pepper spray in. He was thrown into the back of a police van and left in the police station's parking lot where he died. Eric Shaw, a 31-year-old white man, was shot and killed in Iowa City on August 21, 1996, when police entered his art studio unannounced and opened fire. Police later said they were looking for a suspected burglar. On August 10, 1997, Leon Fisher, a 23-year-old African-American, was killed by Nashville police who shot him while handcuffed. Catherine Thompson, 39 years old, was found dead on October 29, 1995, in a Seattle County jail, hanging by her shoelaces after an earlier struggle with the police. Edward A. Anderson, a 28-year-old African-American, was shot and killed on January 15, 1996, by Seattle police. Edward was shot in the throat from 18 inches away while stuck hanging on a fence outside his wife's house. His hands were raised, he was not wearing a shirt, and he was unarmed. On May 13, 1985, 11 members of the MOVE organization, Conrad, Teresa, Raymond, Rhonda, Frank, Tommaso, Catricia, Zanetta, Delicia, Phil Africa, and Vincent Liebhart, were killed after a day-long siege by Philadelphia police, who dropped a bomb on the MOVE house and burned it and 63 other homes in a black community to the ground. Bernard Solomon, aged 19, African-American, died on January 13, 1997. After years of police harassment, Bernard was told by Chicago police that they would kill him. A few days later, he was arrested. He was found hung in his cell. Police claim he hung himself with his shirt, but when his body was examined by family members, they found Bernard was still wearing his shirt on one arm. Santiago Lopez, a 17-year-old Latino, was shot by L.A. County Sheriff's deputies in 1995. Santiago had been playing basketball. He had a cigarette lighter that resembled a gun. The deputies arrived and shot Santiago. When he fell to the ground, a deputy came up and fired two shots to Santiago's head. Santiago was unarmed. Edward Mallett, a 25-year-old African-American, was killed in 1994 in Phoenix. A double amputee, Edward was killed after being placed in a chokehold by police who claimed he was resisting arrest. Yang Xinhuang, a 16-year-old Chinese youth, was killed on March 24, 1995, in Brooklyn, New York, when this ninth-grade honor student was shot in the head by police, who also threw him into a glass door.
On January 12, 1995, police shot two Puerto Rican youths, Anthony Rosero, 18 years old, and Hilton Vega, 21, while they were lying face down on the floor. Anthony was shot 14 times. Hilton was shot 8 times. The officers were former bodyguards of New York City Mayor Giuliani. No charges were filed. Jorge Guillen, a 40-year-old man from Honduras, was killed on October 3, 1995, after family members called 911 and Chicago police responded. Jorge was suffering from schizophrenic hallucinations and holding a 2x4 to keep the door shut. Police threw him to the floor, beat his head with a flashlight, and handcuffed him. One cop stepped on the back of Jorge's neck. He died of asphyxiation, face down, in a pool of his own blood. Angelo Castro Jr., Puerto Rican, was beaten, abused with racial insults, and told by Chicago police he'd be killed if he didn't move away. His family moved. Angel returned to the neighborhood for a friend's birthday party. After leaving the party, a police car rammed him as he rode his bike. As Angel tried to get up, police shot and killed him. He was 15 years old. On May 20, 1997, U.S. Marines patrolling the border with Mexico shot and killed Ezequiel Hernandez Jr., an 18-year-old Chicano, while he was out herding his family's goats. August 20, 1989, Luis Hernandez, a 14-year-old Mexican youth, was struck and killed by a Border Patrol four-wheel drive vehicle as he was running back toward Mexico after trying to cross the border. 3 days later, 22-year-old Anna Ponce was killed in a high-speed chase with Border Patrol agents. 5 days later, 15-year-old Pedro Hernandez was shot and wounded by a Border Patrol agent after Pedro came to the rescue of another immigrant being assaulted by an INS agent. James Johnson was killed in 1995 in Detroit when an off-duty officer shot him to death, claiming he mistook a handheld VCR remote control unit in James's pocket for a gun. Ernest Sayon, a 22-year-old African-American, was killed on April 29, 1994, when police in Staten Island, New York, put him in a chokehold, even though Sayon was already in handcuffs. Quan Chung Cao, a 33-year-old Chinese man, was shot and killed by police in Rohnert Park because he was shouting and waving a broomstick, which police says was done in a martial arts manner. Leonard Acorn Peters, Native American, was gunned down by sheriffs in an ambush on a rural Indian land on April 14, 1995. Alicia Soltero Vasquez and Erika Flores, Mexicans, survived a TV videotaped brutal beating on April 2, 1996, after a truck full of Mexican immigrants was chased by immigrant agents and Riverside County sheriffs. Caroline Sissy Adams, an African-American woman, was shot to death by a white police officer on September 10, 1996, in New Brunswick, New Jersey, after she was questioned about alleged prostitution. Adolph Boyd Jr., a 30-year-old African-American, was killed on April 14, 1997, by Cleveland police. Police shot him at least 12 times in the back as he was walking toward a Wendy's, although police said he was brandishing a gun. None was ever produced. Malik Jones was killed on April 14, 1997, by an East Haven, Connecticut police officer who followed Malik in his car. When Malik's car was boxed in by police, the police broke the window of Malik's car and shot him in the head repeatedly. He was 21 years old.
Dario Miranda, a 26-year-old man from Mexico, was killed on June 12, 1992, in Nogales, Arizona, along the U.S.-Mexico border. Jared Faye Benito, a 16-year-old Filipino, was shot dead on June 7, 1996, in Pearl City, Hawaii. Corey Celo Footman was 19 years old when he was drowned on April 8, 1997, after Miami-Dade police chased him into Snake Creek Canal at Buccaneer Park in Miami, Florida. Reginald Jermaine Canty of Spartanburg, South Carolina, was 22 years old when he was shot dead after he and five friends were out in the country and fired some shots in the air. John Pava, a 37-year-old man, was killed on April 4, 1992, in Reno, Nevada, after three officers came to his house for routine questioning about a disagreement with a neighbor. Andre Jones, a young African-American, was killed on August 22, 1992, in the Simpson County Jail in Simpson County, Mississippi. Kenneth B. Fennell was shot dead on August 30, 1993, by a North Carolina State Highway Patrol trooper. Erdman Bascom, a 42-year-old black man, was killed on February 17, 1988, in the state of Washington, when a police officer knocked down his door without warning in a drug raid at 4 a.m. James Corliss, a 22-year-old African-American, was shot dead on August 9, 1997, in Baltimore, Maryland, after four police officers had surrounded him in a public marketplace. Joseph N. Cooper, Jr., a 21-year-old African-American, was shot dead on November 11, 1995, near Robert F. Kennedy Memorial Stadium in Washington, D.C., by an off-duty police officer.
Nicholas Haywood, Jr., African-American, was shot and killed on September 29, 1994, by a New York City housing cop while Nicholas was playing with a toy gun. He was 13 years old. Alicio Santos Carmona, 24 years old, Mexican, died of injuries on January 23, 1996, after he fell off a cliff near the border with Mexico while being chased by immigration agents at night. On August 9, 1997, Abner Luima, a Haitian immigrant, was arrested outside the Rendezvous Club in Brooklyn, New York. He was beaten in the squad car with fists and police radios. At the station house, he was raped with a bathroom plunger that was then forced into his mouth. The officer who did this reportedly bragged that he had to break a man. Mark Garcia, a 41-year-old Latino man, was killed in San Francisco on April 6, 1996. He'd been robbed and was wandering the streets when police came upon him. They beat and pepper sprayed him, threw him to the ground, grinding a foot into his back. Mark was thrown into a police van and handcuffed. He had a massive heart attack and died the next day. Eric Smith, 22-year-old African-American, was killed in Chicago on April 9, 1996. Eric, who was deaf, was attempting to communicate with police with sign language when they beat him with metal batons and shot him six times. Anthony Baez, a 29-year-old Puerto Rican man, was killed on December 22, 1994, when New York City police officer Francis Lavotti put him in an illegal chokehold after a football struck Lavotti's patrol car. Lavotti was found not guilty. Johnny Gamage, 31-year-old African-American, was killed in 1995 when white police officers in Pittsburgh pulled his car over for allegedly driving erratically and beat and choked him to death. Tyron Lewis, an 18-year-old African-American, was shot to death in St. Petersburg, Florida, by police on October 24, 1996, after Tyron was pulled over for a traffic stop. Tony Gutierrez, a 14-year-old Latino, killed by LAPD on July 29, 1995, when police claimed he pointed a semi-automatic weapon at them. A semi-automatic weapon was found 15 feet away from Tony on the other side of a fence. Witnesses say Tony was unarmed when shot. As one Keyshawn Watson, a 23-year-old African-American, was killed on June 13, 1996, when police in Brooklyn shot at Keyshawn 24 times. 18 bullets hit Keyshawn while he sat in his car with his hands in the air. Kevin Cedeno, a 16-year-old youth from Trinidad, was shot dead on April 6, 1997, in Washington Heights, New York, by police who claimed Kevin went at them with a machete. An autopsy report revealed that Kevin had been shot in the back. Gerald Hall, a 19-year-old African-American, was killed on November 15, 1992, by a San Francisco Bay Area transit officer who accused him of stealing a Walkman. The officer struck Gerald with the barrel of his shotgun and shot him in the back of the head. Douglas Fisher, a 25-year-old African-American, was choked to death on July 20, 1995, by two Best Buy store security guards while Douglas was on the ground, hands behind his back and spitting up blood.
Douglas Fisher was the son of Errol Maitland, engineer of Democracy Now! If you'd like to find out about Stop Police Brutality events in your area, you can call 1-888-NO-BRUTALITY. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Michael J. Haskins was our New York engineer, Andy York our Washington engineer, our director, Leslie George. Julie Drizin is our executive producer, thanks to Zachary Fink. I'm Amy Goodman, thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!